there.
Well, thank you very much for coming out tonight to hear two parts of history that have been really obscured by those in charge of our history. We don't tell our children about these people, although we don't have statues to them, we don't put them on stamps. But these people, we call diminishingly the regicides, are more responsible for liberty in this country, the liberty we enjoy today, than any other group of people. And of course, there are all sorts of resonances in their achievements that I want to mention in discussing them. I don't know why this fear. Bernard Crick wrote a book for immigrants for the government a few years ago, for the Blair government, and about British history, you know, people who come from Estonia or Timbuktu and wanted to know what sort of country, what the history of the country was, and he left out the Civil War of the 1640s. He said that the wounds are still too raw to deal with this period. Everyone here is a little bit royalist or a roundhead or a cavalier. Well, it's odd, really, how we draw this veil over the most important period in our history, certainly for liberty. I suspect it is because, at the end of the day, in order to confirm and consolidate...
revolution that had achieved this, it had made this country the first country. Leave aside Geneva and Venice, little cities there, the first country to have any kind of proto-democracy. It had enforced the right of parliament to share power with the king. It had ended torture. This is an enormously important moment. The Europeans went on torturing for centuries. They got judges to order it whenever they suspected anyone of serious crime. We stopped. These regicides stopped the practice of torture. They abolished the Star Chamber. Until the 1640s, judges held their office only at the king's pleasure. It was actually called a king's pleasure. And if they displeased the king, as Edward Coke did in 1616, out they went. Ship money case. The king, who was wildly wrong in law about his right to tax the exact ship money, actually had the judges threatened for if they dared decide against it. But 1641, we get the independence of the judiciary. We get comparative religious freedom. I mean, in this period, no one was very kind to the Catholics, but they were tolerated at least. The Jews were brought back, allowed to come back. All sorts of sects and so forth were permitted. There was freedom of speech. John Milton, one of the great regicides. We don't hear of Milton as a regicide. We teach our children about his poetry, but not his formidable writings for the Republic. Milton, who was moved to say that censorship that the Presbyterians wanted to bring back was rather like the gallant farmer who thought he'd keep out the crows by shutting his park gate. People as Marvell, another regicide. Well, there you are. These, and of course, a lot of others whose names are pretty much unknown, like Ludlow and Crook and Peters and Vane. Peters and Vane, I have to say, were founders of Harvard University. Go to America and you see their names on streets. I've always seen regicide names on streets as I drive through Boston. But, of course, we pretend they don't exist. Why? I suspect, perhaps, because they cut off the head of the only king who's ever cared about culture. But it does run deep. We rehabilitated Cromwell. Cromwell rather broke the regicides when he abolished their parliament in 1553. And we finally put a statue of him outside the parliament that he'd dissolved so often in the 1890s. But we never really accepted the... Churchill, who was a great fan of Cromwell, wanted to name a battleship after him when George V in 1911, he said, how dare you name a battle and use this offensive oxymoron, His Majesty's ship, Oliver Cromwell. In Australia, when they heard in 1901 that the Australians were going to have federation, call it the Commonwealth of Australia, no way, the British objected. They said, call it the Federation of Australia, because Commonwealth has too many unhappy resonances. So we have a kind of horror of contemplating the execution of Charles I. What I suggest, what I'm going to suggest, is that that execution was not only right in law, but that it was essential in the public interest. Now, I spend much of my life defending people on death sentences in the Caribbean and so forth, but looking at the time and the place, it was essential to consolidate these reforms. I'm sure many of you know the story, it's a wonderful story, but I don't have time really to go into it tonight, about the battles with the Stuarts, those remarkable parliamentarians, Pym and Hampton, rallied, started really, I think they all, poor old Sir Walter was taken off and beheaded by James for utterly cynical reasons, and around his hearing his speech from the scaffold was Pym and Hampton and Elliot, and they went into battle in the 1620s against his son Charles I, wanting some power. It was Edward Coke, the great Chief Justice, who'd been sacked by the King for not agreeing with him, who drafted the Declaration of Right, which reinvented Magna Carta in 1628 as a kind of human rights act to assert against the King. And then the King abolished Parliament for 11 years and ruled and tortured the Puritan preachers. That was when 30,000 Puritans left with John Winthrop to establish the city on the hill in Austin, and then came back, as we'll hear, to fight for the Republican cause. But it was Parliament, brought back in 1640, that made these enormous changes that resounded today. You open the judgments of the House of Lords on whether we can use torture evidence. People who've been tortured in Egypt and Algeria, they quote Magna Carta and the Declaration of Right. Indefinite detention. These should be a living of our inheritance. Well, it's not, because the regicides have been kind of whitewashed out of history, and we're nervous about this period. We should be proud of it. Of course, Parliament went to war with the King. They abolished Star Chamber. They moved towards what I call a proto-democracy. And rotten boroughs still, no universal suffrage. But in the early 1640s, they went to war. It was a very closely fought war for a time, a very bloody war. You have to read the text to realise that there were more British killed comparatively than in the trenches of the Somme in the First World War. For decades afterwards, the British towns and cities were full of veterans of the Civil War with one arm. It was rather like Sierra Leone, where I used to sit as a judge. The mutilation that resulted, 1 in 10 adult Englishmen were killed in those years, 1642. The 1647. And there was always the paradox that was put to Cromwell. If we beat the King 99 times, he remains king. If he beats us once, it's off with our heads. Well, Parliament, led at last by the mighty duo of Fairfax and Cromwell, succeeded at Naseby, which I gather is about to be concreted over for a motorway or something, and today at Naseby Field, and in 1646 the First Civil War was won. But the King, and the king was a captive, but he was still the enemy commander. And this was the extraordinary period where everyone was in awe of the king. He was believed to be God's anointed. He had the power to cure skin diseases by a touch, so many people believed. He was absolute. He had fought this battle for his absolute right to rule, so the parliament wouldn't have any share of the power. He genuinely believed that. He'd been brought up by his father James to believe that he was divinely ordained. So this was an extraordinary problem. How do you have an enemy commander who is your prisoner, but is still your king? And it took several years to work that out. At first, the king was brought back to London. The Putney debates that you're going to hear about from Colin took place, where you had the parliament, the king, the army being much more representative than the parliament, because the army was full of Cromwell's favourite constituency, the middling class of men. And so there, the Liberals, who were these brilliant investigative journalists in a way, who had put before Cromwell, presiding at Putney, their plans for the agreement of the people, a Bill of Rights, in effect, that they would that the law would be no respecter of persons. And the first, I mean, these miraculous debates have come down to us because there was a British shorthand writer there, and his work was discovered locked in a cupboard in Wadham College, I think, a few centuries later. But we do know that when the debates turn from whether the poorest he, as Colonel Rainbow put it, should have the right to vote, then Cromwell asked the shorthand writer to stop when the debate turned to what to do with the king. A man of blood, who had been the cause of the Civil War, had made war, mass murdered his own people. Well, that was the running debate, and the king, in a strange sort of way, survived it, because everyone, most people, still regarded him as the divinely appointed ruler. And no other country at this time, it's an affectation, had any kind of democracy. All of Europe was ruled by kings and princes, except this tiny little city, Geneva. And of course, Cambridge, eminent Cambridge historians today will tell us that British democracy goes back to Athens, the slave owning societies of Athens and Rome. No, it doesn't. It goes back to God fearing, brilliant Puritans who believed in three things. They believed in right reason. They believed in the power of reason. They believed in Magna Carta and the common law, that the law should be no respecter of persons. And they believed in the first book of Samuel, which indicates that God disfavored kings. Well, speaking with those, as it were, tearful, those ideas, brought them in the following year to start thinking about the king, because the second civil war was begun by the king from his prison in the Isle of Wight. He had agreed with the Scots to make a war again, fight again. There were some royalist battalions in the south. They holed up and fought Fairfax at Colchester. There was a great Scots army that came down to put the king back on the throne in return for a squalid deal where the king would make the church of England. It was a very unattractive deal. But down they came, and Cromwell vanquished them, and Fairfax vanquished those at Colchester. But there they were in November and December 1648, with having won a second civil war at the cost of thousands of their comrades killed again. The author of these wars sitting happily at in the Isle of Wight, in this castle with 30 retainers, and plotting a third, because he had not only his son, later Charles II, in Brussels, whoring in Brussels, admittedly, but nonetheless with attracting quite a bit of mercenary support. He had Ormond in Ireland. He had a very strong force of Catholic supporters in Ireland, and there was the possibility that the Dutch, who were pretty opportunist in their, who they supported, would assist with their ships an invasion of England, the Third Civil War. And so the focus turned on what to do with the king, whether he could be put on trial. Well, this was the problem. A lot of people believed that since he was divinely ordained, had absolute power, that he could not be put on trial at all. There were the two top lawyers were on the top side of lawyers, simply on establishment sides, a man called Bridgman and a man called Hale, came up with this theory. They said, well, you can't try him because he's got to be tried by his peers. And the king has no peers, so he can't possibly be tried. The other theory was sovereign immunity. The king is the sovereign. Therefore, he's above the law. This was based on, I think it originally comes from Machiavelli's The Prince. The prince is sovereign, but it was the basis, of course, of sovereign immunity, head of state immunity, the claim that has been made more recently by Pinochet and by Milosevic and Charles Taylor and so forth. But there it was. That was the problem. And it was a terrifying thing. And I think it's right to say that the execution of Charles I was rather like 9/11 in it was that equivalent, sent that amount of shock, certainly through the crowned heads of Europe. But the problem for the regicides, as they're now called, the men who had to prosecute and judge this man, was how to do it. How could you? Logically, what law had he broken? He was above the law. And that was the difficulty. And Parliament, when it came to draw up a brief for the prosecution of the king, thought long and hard about it. And their brief didn't suggest the way that the king should be prosecuted, but it has these words, and I want to read them to you because there is a word here that we hear so much about today. Kofi Annan would use it in every second sentence, but this was the first time it was used, this regicide parliament after Pride's Purge, who actually used these words, that they were putting the king on trial, they erected a high court of justice, to the end that no chief officer or magistrate, they couldn't quite bring themselves to say king, they called him chief officer or magistrate, may hereafter presume traitorously or maliciously to imagine or contrive the enslaving or destroying of the English nation and expect impunity for so doing. This is the first time that the word impunity comes into play in this Kofi Annan sense, impunity, the freedom that tyrants should never have to live happily ever after. Well, it's an extraordinary event, and I can only describe it to you briefly. I've written a book about the amazing intellectual and courageous feats of the prosecutor, a Puritan barrister called John Cook, who had... He wasn't meant to be the prosecutor. He was a brilliant barrister, but no one, because he tended to do what was right, no one quite trusted him as a politician through the ages. Barrister, so they made him the junior barrister. But they, of course, the senior barrister, they thought they could trust, had much more experience, hid under the bed and pretended he was ill. Everyone left the temple. The Lord Chancellor was the first to leave. He jumped in his coach when Cromwell said, we've got to put the king on trial. Then the Cromwell, the Chief Justice, who was Cromwell's best friend, married to his sister, took leave, and so did virtually all the other lawyers. But there was Cook, the Puritan lawyer, who believed. And of course, the key, I think, to the speech of Cook, why he had the courage, was because he believed that everything that happened to him was a manifestation of God's will. And although he was a junior barrister, that would have some purpose. So he got the brief to end the impunity of chief magistrates. How could he do it? You couldn't stay. Because this was treason, and the 1361 Treason Act made it clear that imagining or compassing the death or injury to the king would be treason. So everyone involved in this business knew that they were committing treason. But how logically could he defeat the argument of the king's lawyers that the king had sovereign immunity? And he came up with an idea. He had a week to do it, so it was a pretty amazing effort. But he came up with this idea that if the charge of tyranny, he actually formulated a charge of tyranny, and he based it on not just on the king betraying his trust, but the king being the author of war crimes. And the evidence that he culled and collected in that week was basically evidence of the king supervising the torture of prisoners of war after battles in which the king's forces had some success, and committing the crimes of pillage, which was going into towns, innocent or neutral, and burning houses and destroying property and stealing, and so forth. So, in a sense, the indictment that he drew was rather like the war crimes indictments that we draw today. He was his indictment against Charles I was that trusted with a limited power to govern, and this was the first really republican language entering into the law, trusted with a limited power to govern by and according to the laws of the land and not otherwise. So the beginning was the proposition that the king was under the law, and by his trust, oath, and office being obliged to use the power committed to him for the good and the benefit of the people and for the preservation of their rights and liberties. So he's setting this very much as the king is a public office, and it is bounded by the law, and it must be supportive of liberty. And then here's the get to the crutch. Charles Stuart has been and is the occasioner, author, and continuer of the unnatural, cruel, and bloody wars, and therein guilty of the murders, rapes, and so forth committed in those wars. And that is the basis of what we now in war crimes courts call command responsibility theory, that the commander knows about this, and of course Cook's evidence had the king on horseback actually supervising the torture of prisoners and directing that they be beaten harder and so forth. So that's so it was quite an extraordinary feat to develop a theory that could puncture the sovereign impunity of the head of state. It was extraordinary before its time. And I think that, and then there was a moment at the opening of the trial. It was in Westminster Hall. I don't know whether you've been in Westminster Hall. It's enormous. It's built by Rufus. It was where Richard II was deposed, and it was where Thomas More was tried. But it's an enormous barn of a place. It was, I think, probably about 10 or 15,000 people were packed into it. I went to, while I was writing the book, I went to an event there which had Nelson Mandela, Tony Blair, and Bill Clinton, three of them, speaking. And I was sitting halfway back. I couldn't hear a word. The acoustics are terrible. And I suspect they probably were, so that most of the people could see the king. First of all, the 70 judges came in. They dressed in black robes. The chief judge, only one judge, had been prepared to sit on the basis that he had 30 men guarding him at all time and that he had a hat that was lined with lead. You can still see it, actually. The Smithsonian Museum in Oxford exhibits it, showing the nervousness of the time and the smallness of the crania of the of these people who were all a bit put about 5 foot. But so they came in their broad-brimmed hats and took their seats. And then the king came in, and he was utterly a king in command. You know, he'd been held in some style at Westminster, at Windsor. He kept his hat on, which was an enormous insult to them. And he sort of glared round, and there were all his subjects, 15,000 of them, craning over the balconies that, to see what was going to happen. And the prosecutor, John Cook, the man I write about, stood up to open this trial of the millennium or the century or whatever. Certainly the most extraordinary and most important trial ever taken place in this country. And the king stood up from his chair. He was sitting a couple of feet away. There was a bar a distance from the 70 judges, who were mainly mayors and army officers and so on, just the one judge. And he got up to open. The king had a silver cane. It was a cane with a silver tip. He tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Hold," after he just about as he was just opening his case. And Cook went on speaking. And the king tapped him again and said, "Hold." And the king and Cook, the prosecutor, continued speaking. First time the king had ever been disobeyed. And he hit him really hard, so hard that the silver tip dislodged and fell down between the two men. And the king motioned Cook to pick it up. And there was this moment. Everyone was craning down, all these thousands of people who probably couldn't hear but could actually see what was happening, and saw the king, the red cook. And he didn't. He went on firmly with opening the case. And there was this extraordinary moment, which all the news books commented on the next day, of the king having to bend down, scrabble down on the floor to pick up his own, the silver tip of his own cane, the first time his majesty had bowed to the majesty of the law. And this will be very ominous, said the news books. The king thought it was an ominous portent and thought that indeed Peters had nobbled the cane. And all sorts of conspiracy theories around the cane. And of course, then the king, advised behind the scenes by Bridgman and Hale, he didn't want, rather like Milosevic, because he saw Milosevic on fire and made sure that all his lawyers were in the gallery and that he was seen by the Serbian public as being surrounded by enemies. But the king objected to the jurisdiction of the court. He said, "By what power do you try me?" And it was a very good question, still asked in war crimes court. And this was the first time a judge had to come up with an answer. And Judge Bradshaw, who presided, wasn't the most brilliant of judges, and I think much of his stuff was written by Cook, but he didn't. His exchanges with the king were not quite right, because of course the answer was, "By what power do you drive me?" The answer, I suppose, is the power that has supplanted yours. But it was actually, I mean, Stephen Sidney is a great fellow, he's a judge and historian, tells how when he was taught legal history, he was told to ignore everything that happened between 1640 and 1660, because it was was not lawful. It was an illegal regime. And this was why. I mean, this is why legal history, we've got no idea how badly legal history is taught. It's all taught. It was all property law. Never the state trials, never these great moments. But undoubtedly, I think that there was such a Gracious and Battelle and all the writers. You always have, a conquering army always has the power to court-martial the only leader. And I think that was the basis upon which this wasn't a court-martial. It was actually much fairer than a court-martial, because they'd gone out and found the 70 leading citizens to form a kind of jury. And but there you go. That wasn't, they weren't thinking along those lines. But I don't think, and I've read that trial up and down, I don't think that when they started out, they intended to execute the king. I don't think they knew. I mean, it was a great Puritan thing, wasn't it? You have it in public because it's in the sight of God. You do it, and whatever happens, because it's providence. You wait and see. Providence would decide. And if you read, I think the best behind-the-scenes account of the King's trial is by Lucy Hutchinson. Her husband, Sir John Hutchinson, was one of the judge jurors. I think she gives the best insight in this extraordinary book, wonderful piece of writing, where it's quite clear that they didn't, they thought they're on God's mission, but they thought in the end that the king would probably plead and that they would a deal would be done. But the thing that persuaded them otherwise was not an uncommon event. I mean, the king made the mistake that other notorious prisoners had made of actually talking to his guards. And as he was going down on the second or third day, he told the guards that he hadn't lost a moment's sleep over the dead of the Civil War. The only person who had lost any sleep over being in any way responsible for the death was Strafford, the Earl of Strafford, who had he signed an execution warrant under pressure in 1640. Well, that was reported back, prosecutor to the judges, and it actually, the penny dropped, and they realised this man, who was, and certainly Cook and others respected him because of his absolute dedication to the principle of royal absolutism. He was going right from the start of that trial to be a martyr to it, and a martyr he was, very bravely to it. But so he was a formidable in his passionate belief in his own divinity. He really did think that he was going to be the holy martyr, but they realized that he would never repent, that he would never feel sorry for the deaths, the 1 in 10 English men who'd been killed as a result of his actions. And the other thing that they realized was that the Third Civil War would take place were he to be saved. So that was, I suppose, the cruel necessity side of the decision that at the end was a practical thing. But undoubtedly, I mean, what were the alternatives? Given the enemies in Ireland and The Hague, if he'd been exiled, he would have led, been a focus, and would undoubtedly have led the Third Civil War. If he'd been kept in prison, well, the prisons had been porous and had enabled him to begin the Second Civil War without any difficulty. So the decision was taken to have him executed, and like everything, I mean, there was no hole in the wall execution like Mary Queen of Scots or Anne Boleyn. This was to be in public, and in public it was, and of course he became, by that way, the holy martyr. Martyr was made of him, and come 1660, after Cromwell's death, Cromwell, of course, as I said, broke with regicides by abolishing Parliament and by his rule of the Major General, they felt that he was not loyal to the Republic. He had resisted the crown. It was the regicides that at least persuaded him that if God was disfavoured kings, then he should not accept the crown when one of his parliaments offered it to him. But what he did, and this was ultimately key, the Republic failed, having done so many great things, and completely astonishing things. The Republic failed essentially because Cromwell made one fundamental mistake. When turning down the crown, he accepted a constitution which enabled him to appoint his successor. Mm-hmm. And who did he appoint? Not Ludlow, the representative of the great battle, not Lambert, the brilliant man who would have saved the Republic, sitting down in his house at Putney, but he appointed tumble-down Dick, Richard Cromwell, his eldest son. Mm-hmm. You know, there it is, and Richard Cromwell was not up to it, and so come 1660, and the Republicans were rounded up. Charles II wanted vengeance for his father's death. He wanted everyone, kings, judges, anyone connected with that event, to be executed. And they were. There were terrible rigged trials at the Old Bailey, where not only the men signed the death warrant, but Hugh Peters, the founder of Harvard University, who'd come back and was no more than Cromwell's chaplain. John Cook, the prosecutor, who said with some force that he wasn't an author of the king's death, he was merely doing his duty, taxi on the rank. that was said, he said not to be a mitigation of the defense, but an aggravation. And he was, and they were all sentenced to be hung, drawn, and quartered. And 10 of them were, Cook and Peters amongst them. The hanging, drawing, and quartering was the punishment you got if you weren't an aristocrat and had planned treason. And it involved you being, you were in prison at Newgate, which is next to the Old Bailey, and then you were dragged to Charing Cross about a mile on the back of a cart with your back running along the cobblestone. So you'd be dragged for a mile and be in pretty bad shape by the time you got to the scaffold. And then you'd be taken up and you'd been briefly hanged, but not so you'd lose consciousness, just for a short time, and then cut down. And then it's all fairly gruesome. I think penis and testicles were cut off and thrown to the dogs that were waiting for them around the scaffold. And then your bowels were ripped out, taken out by the executioner by a rather skillful knife. And while you were still conscious, the bowels were burnt in front of your eyes so that you would die in your own stench. This was the worst torture they could come up with for the people who had dared to commit treason. And then, of course, your head was cut off, a hole the head of a traitor, and then your limbs were quartered, the quartering was cutting off, then they'd take them back to Newgate and boil them, and then they'd stick them up on the pikes of London. So in 1660, London just was full of these legs and arms coming up from the various gates of London. And Cook and another man, Harrison, the great general who was responsible for so many of Cromwell's victories, their heads were hung up at Westminster for the birds to eat their eyes out and the white and do what birds do on them. So that was the end of the... But it's very interesting. And quite, it shows you how the resonance of history. There were still hundreds of Republicans in jail after the first 10 had been hung, drawn, and quartered. But their valour, their courage was such, they all made wonderful, enormously moving speeches from the gallows. And the crowds guests who had been, of course, burning roasting ribs and having a wonderful time since Charles II was back, started to swing, started to, because of their courage, the crowd started to swing behind them, and this worried the king, and worried particularly Lord Clarendon, who was the genius behind the whole thing. He was the Lord Chancellor, who had really engineered the king's return. And the king said, what are we to do with them? And we've still got these hundreds of dangerous Republicans in our prison, including Lambert and Vane. And we can't put them on trial, because if we execute them, we have any more executions, we've lost the people. And we can't keep them in prison because of habeas corpus, because habeas corpus was still one of the few liberties that they had. So Clarendon came up with this brilliant idea. He said, I know what we'll do. We'll avoid habeas corpus. We'll stick them on offshore islands where habeas corpus doesn't run. And of course, this was the precedent for British lawyers' arguments about Eternal Bay. And of course, it was regarded as devious even in those days. And when Parliament finally got back its self respect in 1679, it passed the Habeas Corpus Act of 1679, which applies the Great Writ to offshore islands. And in one of the great Supreme Court cases in Bush versus Hampden versus Rumsfeld, the US Supreme Court pointed out to the Bush lawyers that in 1679, America was still part of Britain. They never got round to repealing the 1679 Act that applied habeas corpus to offshore islands. So whirligigs of time. Speaking of which, I should really, I think, round off by saying, look, there are extraordinary reasons. This was a fascinating exercise, the first modern attempt to put a head of state on trial. And the kind of problems that they went through are not dissimilar to the kind of problems we're still going through. It was an essential and a marvellous event because it consolidated the gains of the English Civil War. And these gains were democracy. Let's make no bones about it. Okay, the poorest he wasn't the poorest she. Women were not there, nor did, and the boroughs were pretty rotten, but parliamentary power shared, in fact, excluding the king, was the first time introduced. It doesn't go back to these slave-owning societies of Greece and Athens. It didn't come from the rather pleasant, congenial estates of Rousseau and the French thinkers. It came from those bloody tradesmen, men of the middling class, who fought partly for God, partly for their belief in liberty and Magna Carta, partly, I think, urged on by what was termed right reason. They are the people to whom we owe the abolition of torture, the independence of the judiciary, and so on and so forth. And it is they who were executed and dispersed in 1660. But the problems that they faced in putting the king on trial still live on. Remember, the first thing Pinochet did was to demand sovereign immunity. In fact, it goes back, the first time that Britain picked up John Cook's argument was F.E. Smith, actually, and Lord Birkenhead. At Versailles, he argued that the Kaiser should be put on trial for unrestricted submarine warfare and for invading Belgium. And hang the Kaiser was Lloyd George's mantra. But Wilson, all the others said, oh no, you can't. The Kaiser got to remain unhung. And he was. He went to Holland and was
lived happily ever after, at least, or not happily until he died in despair in 1941. There was impunity too for the Turks, the young Turks, who had caused the Armenian massacres, the Armenian genocide, dare I say it, for the Turkish audience who were in Turkey. But and we put a few of them on trial in Malta, but then it wasn't carried through. And one remembers Hitler. I don't remember him, but you remember what he said to his generals on the Polish border, urging them to show no mercy. He said, "After all, who now remembers the Armenians?" So there was it was, of course. Then we have the Second World War and the Americans' desire to put Hitler and Co. on trial. And this is fascinating because, in fact, Churchill, who was a great admirer of Cromwell, thought that the regicides had made a great mistake. He thought they should have just killed Charles. His imagination was quite remarkable, and his reading of this time was, and I think we have to thank the registrars in a way for not taking it so easy to shoot him while escaping. At Carisbrook Castle, the king could have been shot, and you know, he tried to escape on several times, and someone who apprehended him violently was actually put on trial. They did not touch, they did not take the easy way of poison or shooting while escaping. And Churchill had opposed Nuremberg vigorously because he said, look at the trial of Charles I. Hitler will use this as a soapbox to justify his policies. We're not going to put them. He came up with this solution. He said, we've got to declare the top 75 Nazis would be declared outlaws. They would be shot 6 hours after their apprehension. Just put up and, before a firing squad. They'd be given 6 hours to say their prayers. And oddly enough, it was Truman and Jackson, Justice Jackson, his advisor, who said, this would not sit on the American conscience or be remembered by our children with pride. We must give them the fairest trial that the horrors of the time will permit. So there was a complete break between Britain and America on the issue of whether the Nuremberg trial should ever take place. And, of course, it was this deadlock that was broken by the third ally, Joe Stalin, who loved show trials, as long as everyone got shot in the end. So it's thanks to Stalin that we got the Nuremberg trial that Churchill feared would be a replay of the trial of Charles I. And it started off that way, although Hitler, of course, fortunately for Churchill, committed suicide. And so Goering was the head of state. There was one head of state in it, actually, Admiral Dönitz, who had been head for a while. And Goering called everyone together at the beginning. He didn't say we're going to do the Charles I strategy, but more or less he said, all we're going to say in this kangaroo court is, it was a catch cry, one of Goethe's warrior heroes, loosely translated as kiss my ass. And that was all they were going to say to the judges. But then, of course, they got sucked in because the fairness was a fairish sort of proceedings. They saw the opportunity they'd have to make their, give their evidence to posterity, and they decided to cooperate. And there's a wonderful, we war crime judges who have defendants who kick and scream and try to destroy the court look with nostalgic delight at Goering coming up with his great sheaf of notes to plead guilty, and the British judge saying, Mr. Goering, this is not a time for a speech. Are you guilty or not guilty? And sort of collapse literally of stout party as he dropped his notes, pleaded not guilty and went back. But, of course, the Nuremberg then became a kind of totemic legend. I mean, we did it. What John Cook and Cromwell failed to do in 1649, we've done in 1946. But, of course, it wasn't as easy as that. And it took
And we still face these problems about what do you, about the procedure, what you do with non-cooperating defendants, how do you supply them with lawyers against their will, and so on and so forth. A lot of the problems that were considered 360 years ago. What do you do with them? What's the alternative to execution? This came up in some discussions I was involved in between the British and American authorities over the trial of Saddam. I'd given some training to the Iraqi judges, and there's no doubt in my mind that they were, A, they wanted the trial to be held in The Hague, B, they wanted to be part of an international court with international judges, and C, they wanted to try the genocide case, the Anfal campaign. But the Americans were dead opposed, and so there was this, and ultimately, of course, it came down to the problem of the death sentence. The Americans wanted Saddam Hussein dead, and so they couldn't try him in an international court because international courts don't have the death penalty. They said to us, because the British, Lord Goldsmith and Blanchard, the prospect of being involved in a hanging, and we were at loggerheads, and they said to us, well, all right, what you really want him in prison in Iraq for the next few years? What's your alternative? And we scratched our heads because it was a fair point. You do with a tyrant who can't be executed. Anyway, I came up with the idea. I said, why don't we do what we did with Napoleon? And put him in Saint Helena. And the Polkovs actually made some inquiries. They came back very crestfallen. They said, well, unfortunately, the Saint Helenans want to turn their island into a tourist resort. They want an airport. They think this would not be a good idea. So he said, well, what about the Falklands? You could get some use for the Falklands. You could have Saddam and the loss of it sort of communing with the penguins for the rest of their life. But that didn't work. We didn't carry that around. The Americans were determined to have him strung up, and they got their way, didn't they? So, and that was something of a travesty of justice, I'm afraid. So, I suppose at the end of the day, it is interesting, I guess, certainly to those of us who are in business, to see how what was achieved and what the problems were in putting the king on trial. It was it is a broader thing of just how astonishing for its time and place were the achievements of the regicides in the English Republic. How many of our liberties that we have today we owe to their theorising, because their achievements couldn't be totally wound back in 1660. And thirdly, I guess, the irony of how this country, which has so much liberty to boast of, in a sense, draws a veil over it, and is, for one reason or another, unable. I mean, you have no idea what the... I researched the school syllabus, and apparently, and at the age of 12, I think our kids are allowed to have a little glimpse into this period, and they're taught that the year of 1649 should be taught as the year of vengeance, as the year of violence, this year in which, and they should concentrate on the execution of Charles I as an example of that violence. Bizarre that the year of, what was it called, the first year of freedom by God's blessing restored, should be taught to children as simply a year of violence and not as a year of freedom. But that is the mindset, that is the way in which this race of courtiers, I think we are, has, because of the horror we find at the execution of a monarch, draw a veil over the true achievements of this time. Thank you.
questions for Jeffrey? We've got the time for a few.
Can you ask us why we can't bring Tony Blair to trial for what he's done in Iraq?
Well, I've just been reading a wonderful book on that very subject by Vince Bugliosi. Have you remember Vince?
No, sorry.
Vince Bugliosi. He's an amazing American. He prosecuted Charles Manson. He's very over the top, the brilliant American prosecutor who argues the case for being pushing there on trial. Look. The problem with doing anything about the invasion of Iraq is that it is, if it's a crime, it's the crime of aggression. Okay? Now, we have not, the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction to investigate and punish the crime of aggression, but it hasn't been defined yet. It is a jurisdiction that only comes about after a conference in 2010, which is being held in Uganda, in which the signatories will attempt to define aggression. And I'm afraid, well, at least we're going to get a definition of aggression, aggression will somehow be defined as something that the security, we'll have the Security Council in. Okay, so the Big Five will be able to veto any decision on that. And that's absolutely, we are at, but we didn't evolve very far after the trial of Charles I. We had the trial of Louis and one or two others, but we are still, we have only picked up on the Nuremberg legacy with the ICC statute in 98, we're 10 years on. And so it will take quite a while.
So even though innocent non-combatants were bombed to hell, they...
Yeah, I think that's unfortunately the reality of our politics is that we can get you if you're a failed state, we can get you if you're a pariah state. We've got Charles Taylor under trial at the moment. Megistu is being protected by Mugabe. Went to Cape Town for a heart operation. Press discovered him. Rushed back to Zimbabwe. Harare. That's where we are at the moment. We are. I mean, there are important developments in the sense that the rules that get worked out and promulgated applying to these lower level dictators are nonetheless there, and the Americans have to mind how they get. When they, during the Kosovo War, they were starting to understand what war law that's developed in other contexts involved. So it's not a. And there was very. I was fascinating the other couple of months ago when the Supreme Court decided that struck down, actually, the thing that courts in this country could begin to do. Bush and Congress and Senate have passed a law abolishing habeas corpus for Guantanamo detainees. And the Supreme Court, very narrow, the four Bush appointees against the five decent people in judges, decided to strike this down. It's unconstitutional. And McCain said immediately this is the worst decision they've ever made. And Obama very carefully, because the guy is a constitutional lawyer, explained that this was, we supported Nuremberg, and as Americans we should be grateful that we did the conventions that have protected our people, and so on and so forth. So I don't despair of America at the moment, and I think that the precedents that are being set in relation to these middle rankers, make misbehavior by great powers a bit less likely, and B, do act in mind time and go.
Just a slight diversion. There are these things about civil liberties being whittled away in our country. And I know that's not subject to your talk, but I think that's be quite interesting to hear you talk about that sometime. The other thing...
Right, that may be another talk.
Yeah, the other thing, well, something more relevant. a while ago, some people from Bristol went into Fairford Air Base and damaged some aircraft and stuff. They took the thing all the way up the legal system, and they were told that the defence, that the legality of the war was not something that could be talked about in British courts.
No, Jones, case of Jones.
That's right, yeah. It seems to me that's actually got something quite close to us and something that most people had no idea that that was so. Mm. And that seems to me, you know, it's startling. And
well, I was...
It means the head of state is above the British law.
But I was... Done over by Jones's case, because I was last year represented a guy up on treason, on one of these brand new treason terrorist, anti-terrorist laws, which made it a crime to compass or imagine the overthrow of any government or person. It was incredibly broad. And this guy was a Libyan, and the only person in the world he wanted to kill was Colonel Gaddafi. And he'd drawn up a blueprint in which it, for an underground movement against Gaddafi, which was full of, you know, warnings against people not to kill anyone but Gaddafi himself. And you know, was he guilty of this crime, carrying life imprisonment? Or was the jury at least, was he guilty as a matter of law? Or was the jury at least allowed to hear him give evidence and understand how members of his family had been killed by Gaddafi, how he wanted, I'm not quite sure what he wanted, but that was part of the problem. But it was an interesting point of law, and the argument based on Jones' case was no, he couldn't. Even if he'd been someone who wanted to overthrow a tyrant by any type of forcible means, they would be guilty of a serious crime now under the Terrorism Act. Nelson Mandela, undoubtedly. And the court said, yes, Nelson Mandela would now be a criminal.
But doesn't that all go to mitigation?
Yes,
that's
what it does now.
But the point that I would... Jones is a case which says you can't even... You can't have a defence, or you can't explain if you, said, that there was a public interest in your actions.
You can't question the government or the Prime Minister about his decision to go to war. That's not something that you can discuss in the courts.
You seem to have gone against Jones' cases, but it is, yeah, you're quite right.
The regicides who were not executed, Ludlow, I think you said, and
yes,
one or two
Ludlow.
Others, were they actually exiled, and did they live out their lives in exile?
Yes, if you ever go to Geneva, take a bus or cab to Vevey.
This is several hundred people.
Yes. Okay. They were put on islands. Most of them put in Jersey. Ludlow. There was a preposterous, monstrous thing, where two of the most brilliant regicides, Henry Vane and Algernon Sidey, were executed in Hungary and Hungary in 62. They had nothing to do with the king's death, and they had actually been an undertaking by the king not to execute them. But they were regarded as too dangerous, and so they were executed. Vane was executed in 62. He was the first governor of Massachusetts. He was a remarkable figure. You may not believe this, but I gave a talk
on this period at Eton last week, where at the invitation of the student who was president of the History Society, his name was Henry Bain. He was a direct descendant, amazing, of the. So I talked about his great-great-great-great-grandfather's death. But the other really, well, the guy who would have saved the Republic was Lambert. And Lambert, they were going to execute Lambert at the same time, but Lambert was prepared to save his skin by pleading guilty, and they put him in an island off Portsmouth Harbour with instructions to his jailers that they were to kill him if there was any rescue mission.
And Geneva?
Well, there was, in Geneva, about four or five of them, including Ludlow. Ludlow was the greatest living English Ludlow. Yeah, he came back. Ludlow was the only one who was sort of alive and kicking at the Glorious Revolution. So he came back to London, and the government then, this was 89, so he lived for 30 years after the government moved to have him arrested and put on trial for treason. That's so much for the Glorious Revolution. So he scuttled back to, and his grave, you couldn't see his grave by this very beautiful church in Vevey. There were two stories that emerged from all the Republicans who went round the world. I mean, those George Downing is a fascinating character. Downing was the first graduate of Harvard University, George Downing. He came over, he played Kissinger to Cromwell. He was the foreign diplomat. But of course, Downing Street is named after him, but it's named after him because come the Restoration, he gave total allegiance to the king. He went over and he lured three of his old friends, people who had promoted him and people, his priest, his commander, who were regicides in hiding. He lured them to The Hague and had them arrested and then took them back and executed on Tower Hill. So we really should one day change the name of Downing Street. He became a massively wealthy. He advised Charles, he was a treasurer in effect, Charles II. But that he was the worst of the turncoats. A number of the regicides got to America and Boston. And they were, and of course, the people in Boston kept getting missives from the king to have them arrested, but they protected them but then when the king sent agents over to have them killed, and they disappeared, and there is a wonderful story told of the how one of the communities was being threatened by Indians, and this little town about 100 miles from Boston was surrounded by Indians, and they were subject to a tomahawk attack, and they all thought they were going to be scalped. And then suddenly there appeared from some basement this grave and revered fellow with beard, and he told them how to form in a roundhead formation. And they beat off the Indians. And so this story is told of one of the regicides who sort of miraculously emerges to save the town by using the Ironsides tactics. So they are, a lot of them, John Cook's daughter, I tracked down to Antigua. A lot of the Cromwell's men went to the colonies, and of course, there's no doubt that their spirit lived on very much in New England and Boston. And if you read the Federation papers, the founding fathers, Hamilton and Madison and Jefferson, if you're watching John Adams, which is a production, it's on, I think it's on Saturday, it's on Channel 4, you see how much they were influenced in their attempts to defeat Bayes at the hands of George III's forces by the folk memories of the regicide.
Okay, one more question.
Well, why was there no move against Richard Cromwell to prosecute him, imprison him, immediately he lived for another 50 or 60 years? Why was there no feeling that he was the Lord Protector? What was going on there?
Tumbledown Dick was just so pathetic that I don't think anyone could have any kind of fear of him. Henry Cromwell, the younger, it was the old story, the younger son in Ireland, very, only 28, but had a bit of the old man's spirit. But Richard, I think, was mentally handicapped. He just walked around. He was bankrupt, of course, and he walked around. He came to Parliament, actually, to try and evade his creditors. but he didn't seem, he seemed to be so inoffensive that no one took offence. Of course, he hadn't been a regicide. Mm. He hadn't been involved in any way in the king's death, so he was allowed to live. But the danger, whether they were regicides or not, were put on Ireland and were died in quite sadly. I think there were one or two who were. There were a couple who had themselves saved royalists who were allowed to go. Milton is a classic example, actually, of someone who got away with it because Milton was saved by his brother, who had become high up in the pecking order in Charles II's circle, and by William Davenant, who was probably Shakespeare's illegitimate son, who was had worked with him. He was a musician, composer, and he was very high too in Charles II's and the Stuart estimation. So, but certainly the man who prosecuted the regicides, this is to General Finch, argued that Milton should be executed. He spent a few months in prison. Marvell was another person who, an MP who survived. There had been a lot of interrelationships, obviously. If you had a relation in the court of Charles II, or if you'd done a service for a royalist leader, then your neck might well be saved and you might not be put in prison.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Geoffrey for coming on the show. We have a very short book to go to the loo, buy a drink, buy a book from the bookstore, and then we'll come back for Colin Thomas.